This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show. F'ing up the airwaves since 2007. F Word is a syndicated show produced in Vancouver, BC, Canada at CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. For more information about the F Word Media Collective, you can go to our website at feminisms.org. You can hear our shows through that site, plus co-opradio.org, rabble.ca, archive.org, Pacifica Radio, and iTunes. And every week we broadcast live from the downtown east side of Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territory. I'm Ariana Bearer.
And I'm Carissa Raponin, and today on the show, we are going to be airing performances from the Sister Spit Ramblin' Roadshow in Vancouver. Sister Spit is a queer feminist spoken word and performance art collective from San Francisco, and their first incarnation of the group ran from 1994 to 2006, and was later revived by co-founder Michelle T, a Sister Spit The Next Generation. So last week, we aired the first part of the Vancouver Sister Spit show, which was live here in Vancouver on March 26th. And tonight we're going to be airing two more performances by Sister Spitters, Shanaka Hodge and Virgie Tovar. So please stay tuned for recordings from those powerful, funny, and intense performances. Please also note that these pieces include swearing and sexual content, so please adjust your radio dial accordingly.
What you are about to hear is spoken word by Shanaka Hodge from the queer feminist touring roadshow Sister Spit at their Vancouver show on March 26th. Hodge is a poet, educator, playwright, and screenwriter, originally from Oakland, California. She received the SF Foundation's Phelan Literary Award for Emerging Bay Area Talent and was the artist in residence at the Headland Center for the Arts in Marin, California in 2012. Again, please be aware that this show contains swearing and sexual content.
She is somebody that I met when she was a mere teenager. She was a superstar of the poetry, of the national poetry slam scene in the United States, and has traveled all over the world, has written plays. She's been a Sundance Fellow at the Sundance Lab in Utah. She has a book called For Girls with Hips. She's writing a sequel to her play, Mirrors in Every Corner. She's a joy to travel with. Please welcome to the stage, Shanaka Hodge. While doing and moving, you'll meet a Brutus and Judas. Truly, if they'll kill Caesar or Jesus, believe us, they'll scuff you for your sneakers. Cuz. Don't need a reason in Cleveland, Toledo, to Peter, to greet you with a need of policemen. When heaters is trained to fly off fetus, it's precinct to precinct. They'll end us. They'll simply end us. Our mamas are bombs, prostitutes, and scouts. Get your work out of the noble boy. I know guarantee the dollar is only paper and cotton. Your 48 has been taken hostage. Made you mulatto. Trade you at auction blocks. Watch you become a pilot.
Sitting in the back of the bus, dying my hair purple, controlling something, anything besides the stress mask, or anything, my body seems so
meeting in Vancouver. On being the other woman, I had $4 in quarters exactly, which I'd been saving for the time I'd get on Saturday to do my wash. It was late as shit on Tuesday when he called, and an hour and a half in my car, assuming no cops, no traffic, no second thoughts. The time at his place was uneventful. That's all I'll say. It was warm and familiar. I laughed on his stomach, brushed my teeth before we lay down. He was brown. That's all I'll say. I pulled the covers off my face in the morning and drove home lamenting poor decisions like spending my last dollars on toll and not the laundry, on gas money and not my traffic fines. I got stuck in early morning commute in Richmond next to the oil refinery. When my music stopped playing, all that was left was the careful hum of a cracked timing belt and the way my panties collided into themselves, pulled on in a hurry, chafing, matching the way I told myself one day. One day, he'll care. I was late to work and felt guilty then, too. Had to make up my hours on Saturday, which was good since I couldn't afford to do my wash anyway. That was late summer. This is late fall. He and I have been through months now, weeks at least. His smell is still all in my sheets. Sometimes he come through here. Still the smile he wear for her on. Extra swipes of deodorant. The toothpaste he like wearing the t-shirt I bought him. I can't be mad. What can I say? He smell like him, which I like. Liked. Sometimes I confuse my loneliness for his affection. He say he don't even care for the way I kiss, won't touch me unless he's a little bit drunk or has convinced himself I matter more. In this moment, he brings her to bed often, at least the thoughts of her, which makes him sweat, which turns me on, which makes me cry. And he's good about drying tears, which means the three of us are lying here together, even when it's just me. His scent is tangled in bedclothes I meant to wash months ago, weeks at least. It's gonna take time to undo this, but I borrowed $4 from the kids upstairs to clean my sheets and slept fitfully the first night. I couldn't smell him still, tossed so hard I snapped my bed frame. It's the cleanest break yet. I shall do for you one more poem. I'm from Oakland, California. Anybody here from the West Coast? You're all from the West Coast, but like, from like, you know, Southern West Coast. You know, it's nice to be a black woman in a space not my own. So let me tell you about my hometown. It's a love note to Oakland. Before the fancy showed up, Michelin starred you, covered your neck tats and patched your broken windows, renamed your longest boulevards and posted you on Craigslist, I was there. I remember my street, Phaeton, before the turn of the millennium and feeling like we'd cheated, regular old poor. Feel like we might got found out and asked to leave, one of a few black families who cheated, regular poor, and became standard middle class. Then again, there was another house on Myrtle, which was hood if not nothing. If not police taped and haunted as the rest of the block, maybe I wouldn't still be so close to my goons who, last week when I told them somebody might have to die because of how he did me, didn't even flinch. I have loved every sort of gold grill, devoured every sort of deep fried thing East 14 has to offer, kissed every kind of black man named Chris who showed off his smile like a new pair of Jordans. Sometimes my town has used his fists against me, but if I don't love him hard and good and fast and forever, no one will. The choice is clear, ride or die, so I vow against the death, passenger seat, the full expanse of the bottoms of Telly, of 7th and Market. I tongue kissed the town with the tops of my shoes, folded over and stuffed with socks, how my cousin taught me on the first day of junior high. I tetherball this hood, wrapping ropes around my hand, calling no touchbacks. I jump this city, less like a gang initiation, more like double dutch, but when placed side by side, these actions are almost identical. Both include lifting your knees and putting your feet to the pavement as if your life depends on it. Let's be clear, your life does depend on it. In Oakland, anyone can die at any time for any reason, and those of us who survive trace the branches of a tree onto the extra pieces of our skin as if we are challenging our home to come and get us. Honestly, this is a secret I don't tell very many people. I'm allergic to oak. So say the doctors at Kaiser, so confirm the emergency room at Pill Hill. I struggle to breathe whenever I'm home. If that's not a metaphor for the way I love any man in any city, especially my own, I don't know what it is. If this is a love note to a town that does not know my name yet, that will never send me postcards from other exciting locales like Vancouver, that will not pick its roses and send them bundled to the door at 40th and Opal, that does not remember me fighting sleep against ghetto birds on East 17th, that does not ache to see me when I'm away, know this. I still sing the prettiest songs about you when I'm away. I search for signs of you in New York, Atlanta, Los Angeles, even Columbus, Ohio. I talk about the year the Dubs almost did it, the year that Mac went all the way, the free breakfast programs and the marches to the ports and the festivals at the lake. I omit the losing, the COINTELPRO, the hipsters, the complications and the death. I try not to talk about the death. You are my boo. Boo, we're talking. We're kissing behind the Safeway in Montclair and fashioning illicit instruments out of Pepsi cans, sniffing sunshine cookies in the deep east and dating for a dollar on Wednesdays. Why would I talk about you bad in the streets? Why would I press anything but honey to your lips? Why would I act like I haven't loved you deep and hard since they first brought me home from Alta Bates? Sure, I was born in a Berkeley hospital, but since then I've denied all other lovers since 1984. Why should I start cheating now? I remember you the way you used to be when I was squat and you were empty and no one wanted to live inside you but me. And now I can't hardly get a word in edgewise. I'm in a scraper driving the perimeter of my city, hoping it will call after me. Ay, thick chick. Say, could you have a friend take my number? Here, look at my hind parts. Here, wonder if you'll ever get to hit those again.
Up next is more spoken word readings from Sister Spit. Here is Virgie Tovar, one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on fat discrimination and body image. She is the editor of Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Life, Love, and Fashion from 2012. I love that name, Hot and Heavy. I think that it's so clever. She writes about the intersections of size, identity, sexuality, and politics. Please be advised, this does include swearing and sexual content, so adjust your radio dials accordingly.
Rocking incredible outfits. She's a speaker and an activist and an academic and a lover. And she has a book over there that she edited, an anthology called Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Life, Love, and Fashion. Please welcome the inimitable Virgie Tovar.
I told my friends to the party that I would wear this Miss Piggy head in honor of them. So I'm going to take it off now, and I will explain to you.
So I'm actually having this adventure in my love life where, after dating many radicals who inspired me politically and did all kinds of wonderful, amazing things, and just dazzled me with their politics, but just not kind of in other ways. I decided that I was going to date a libertarian. And, it's funny because we were talking about my politics and his politics, and, I was sort of telling him, Miss Piggy is a big influence for me. She's somebody who really motivates my life, and she's somebody who I homage. And he was like, I don't know. That's kind of like my general impression of him. And then on Christmas, there's a sack like that shows up at his house, and he's like, "What's that?" And it turns out there's a box inside the sack, and there's two boxes. One is like a huge, I didn't wear it tonight, but it's like a Betsy Johnson bright pink sequined rhinestone covered lobster. And then the next box is the Miss Piggy head. And I'm just like, it's just like this total shock. Like, I wouldn't have even taken it there. But he did. So it has a lot of meaning for me because of that. But also just because Miss Piggy is someone I channel often and who's kind of been like a fat femme inspiration for me for a really long time. So that relates very, obviously, very, very heavily with my book. Hot and Heavy is an anthology. There's 31 contributors in the book, and I'm going to read you my chapter. So I'm going to be talking about sex. I'm going to be talking about being fat. I'm going to talk about being made fun of because I'm fat. And then there's going to be like a fun thing at the end, okay? I am one of those progressive, loving, fat activists, fat girls. I'm one of those whoopie pie in one hand, vibrator in the other hand kind of fat girls. I'm one of those take no prisoners, potty mouth, kiss my ass, gorilla fatties. And my weapons of choice are pink, glitter, cleavage, and impossibly short dresses. And no, I'm not sorry. People often want to know how exactly a fat brown girl manages to learn to love a body that is perpetually under attack. Well, loving my body took a long time. And like any good love story, there was drama and tears, false starts and heartbreak, pecan pie binges, and dirty sex. In the beginning, I was born under a funny star. My grandma says that the angels went through the entire baby Bloomingdale's in heaven just to find me. Some of the babies were too light-skinned to be a half-Mexican, half-Iranian baby, and some had freckles, which no one in the family had. Some were too skinny, and some didn't have any hair on their heads. By the time my mother was on the delivery table screaming and hurling epithets, my fate had been determined. The angels had chosen a little fat girl with curly black hair, a penchant for sweet things, and a tendency towards sexual precociousness. Imagine 4 fat Mexicans and 1 chubby little half Mexican driving to get Chinese takeout in a 1979 Pinto, and you've got the day after my birth. My grandma says that I slept peacefully during my time in the hospital, but the moment I smelled that mooshu, I was awake and ready to fulfill my destiny. As a little girl, I was self-assured and had an affinity for flirtation and sweet and sour pork. I liked dressing up, and I liked masturbation. I'm not sure how I figured out how to masturbate, but I thought I was the only person in the world who knew it existed and spent many an evening planning out how I would make my fortune by training people to do it to other people for a lot of money. I was hot shit in preschool. I had an uber hot Chinese boyfriend named Ray Ray. And he loved me for my body. Ray Ray was about half my size, and every day after school, I remember feeling my heart beating quickly, pumping blood into my cheeks. I could hear it loudly in my ears. I would lie spread out completely like a little olive-toned, pot-bellied snow angel, and I would wait for Ray Ray to run from the edge of the rug that had the alphabet and the numbers 0 through 10 embroidered into it. He would run from the edge and fall on top of me, loving me, laughing with me, hugging me. The age of 5 proved to be the year of my inauguration into a world where my fat wasn't hot anymore. I lost my sense of self when I was introduced to the evil, dark, and horrible world of primary school. I began being made fun of every day, and the crushes I had were violently unrequited, so I simply learned to stop having them. I tried to ignore the kids who teased me, but they were surprisingly not to be deterred. I tried to diet, but that usually didn't last more than a few days. So by the time I was 15, I had immersed myself fully into pastimes more suitable for social outcasts: the marching band, the debate team, church, and the Junior Classical League, the club for fat, acne-ridden, college-bound high schoolers who love the language of ancient Rome. Latin. Sometimes after school, my mom would take me to what we called simply the canned food store, which is like the Ross for food. Everything was slightly irregular. The last stop, the food morgue. When enormous cans of peaches got dented, they got sent to the canned food store. When a huge batch of chocolates was wrapped with the wrong wrapper, it was sent to the canned food store. And sometimes you had to guess what might be wrong with the food because there were no visible signs of irregularity. But they took food stamps and we had those. The canned food store had the best pecan pies in the whole world. I've always had a love of pastries, and it doesn't get much better than some good-ass pecan pie. My mom loved pecan pie, too. She never knew quite how to deal with the anguish that my fat caused me as a child, but she always had a new tip on how to beat it. There were all ideas she'd tried on herself first, I could tell. That day, we made a trip to the canned food store because I'd been made fun of for the millionth time, and I was inconsolable. She said that a sure way to lose weight was to learn to hate the food that tasted the best, because that food was what made you fat. She said we could eat one whole pecan pie each and eat the whole thing till we were sick, and then the idea of pecan pie would never appeal to us again. Therefore, crossing it off the list, ready to move on to the next sinful item. I can still remember how good that pecan pie was. And how I knew in my little subversive heart that I could never give up pecan pie. I didn't finish the pie or get sick, but I guess to set the stage for more experiments. Puberty in my grandparents' conservative, religious Mexican household was hard on my burgeoning sexuality. I refer to that era as pussy lockdown. I wasn't allowed to date or go out alone. Walking to the mailbox on the corner was pushing it. I was not taught to ride a bicycle or skate, nor was I allowed near a trampoline or a car. Lest I attempt to escape and what, suck every dick in the neighborhood? I'm not sure what they were afraid of. Girl, they knew. By the time I was 18, my hormones were ready to have a debutante ball all their own. My young adulthood was just about to begin. It would prove to be the point in my story where those punk-ass suburban kids got proven wrong. The point in my story where I would discover my delicious sexuality anew and how my round, chubby body was every bit a part of that deliciousness. Once I officially became a grown-up, I found the love for myself that I'd lost so many years before. I attribute some of the self-love rediscovery to the part of my brain that knew that something just wasn't right with a world that told me that I had to wake up every morning to the fascistic sound of an alarm clock, a world that said I had to exercise and eat carrots, a world that said that ice cream was bad. Some of the self-love came from all the people I fucked. Everything I experienced sexually and romantically was against everything that Cosmopolitan and Ab Roller ads had said about life all those years. If my body wasn't hot, then why did my lovers want me to model lingerie? Why did they take me shopping into fancy restaurants? Why did they want to squeeze my fat during foreplay? Why did they want to kiss my belly, suck my toes, ask me to jiggle my boobs in their face? Even more baffling, sit on their face. Why did they buy me presents or ask me to tie them up or call them dirty names? I thought that's not what people are supposed to want to do with 230-pound women, and here I was having my ass eaten and being thanked for the privilege. Then I was introduced to feminism. I started to become excited about the idea of being a radical fat girl, and one day, when a woman on the commuter train told her boyfriend in a loud whisper that I was too fat to wear the very fabulous outfit I had on, I gave her a big slice of bitch pie. I walked right up to her, my face no more than a foot from hers. And I told her that my body was mine and that I could wear whatever I wanted and that she needn't be threatened by my short skirt and that I looked good, real good. I did not insult her or berate her. I simply felt it polite to inform her that the era of fat girl apologies and tastelessly retrograde fatphobic remarks is coming to a close. And the day of the fierce too much to handle fat girl is close at hand. And then I sat down right next to her. We sat there in silence for 45 fucking minutes. From downtown San Francisco all the way to the motherfucking Pacific Ocean. The end of the line. I felt like the Rosa Parks of fat that day. All right. I've learned about the power of my fat from a lot of people. I've learned that it makes some people happy and others mad, some horny and others critical, some comfortable and others ill at ease. I've learned that my body is yummy and that loving it is far more fun than not loving it. Like real love, I've got to fight to keep it. Like real love, I've got to believe I deserve it. Like real love, I mess up over and over, but I forgive myself and I try not to make the same mistakes again. When you're a fatty, eating a cupcake in public is a radical act. When you're a fatty, wearing a short skirt or a tight dress is revolutionary. When you live in this world, loving your round, flabby body is avant-garde. We're the coolest people we know. Self-love is a minute-to-minute entity. It never stops being hard to love yourself in a world that tells you that you'll never be good enough. Self-love will not save you from getting your heart broken, but no act of love, especially self-love, will ever be a wasted effort. Being a fabulous fat girl is not easy. It may be the hardest thing one ever decides to be. I'm criticized. I am chastised for my role in spitting on the shiny brown loafer of the man. People are jealous and passive aggressive. They whisper. They haterade. But I strut my ass through the world with the knowledge that no one can touch the secret part of me that knows I'm a queen. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into the F Word today, and thanks to all the performers of Sister Spit. If you like what you heard tonight, please visit feminisms.org to listen to part one of the Sister Spit performances.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show, effing up the airwaves since 2007.